I think this thing's working now, which means I suppose that we can think about getting started. You have some paperwork there. I've got some paperwork here. I don't know if you want to close the door.
Just tell me what kind of format you think about. You think in terms of asking questions?
Well, yeah.
And you responding?
Just starting out with...
You have... Now, let me tell you that I have had... We had a push-up 2 weeks ago.
Oh, boy.
In Ball, Iowa. Odell and I both wondered whether all the bacteria... the viruses were killed or not in that.
Yeah.
Because we've been under the weather ever since.
Oh, my.
And we're just getting out of it. In fact, last night for the first time, I wasn't taking medication last night. I was taking medication every night.
Trying to get over it. Where you wonder if the disease is worse than the cure.
I don't know that I can really blame that. I probably shouldn't blame the... a flu shot on it, but anyhow.
Okay, well, let's shuffle a whole lot of paper here and get back to where we need to be, which I think is right about here.
You got that? You got the outline?
Yeah.
Yeah. This is all good material that we need for the get started.
Now then, I thought I checked this file before I started, and I have an outline here somewhere. I may have to borrow that one back.
Okay, now here's the one that's
here, I think.
Yeah. Starts off with CD. No, that's the list of things that you that you wanted.
Here we go.
Then we get to the stock.
Here we go.
To the stock interview, the oral history outline.
Yeah. I think one of the things that I think is particularly interesting about this business is the idea that, particularly in mass spectrometry at the time you guys came into it,
it was an unknown area, and so you're really pioneers. And I think the early background, these people, you know, parental background and education and attitude towards science and that kind of stuff is important, because it was a whole new field. So I don't know. Tell me a little bit about
it. Let me ask this.
Okay.
I sent you this, which I rewrote.
Yeah.
So you can tell I've already retired here.
Yeah.
So this, we don't need to go with this, do we?
I think this is like represents the supporting documentation.
And
I think if there's any, we need, in other words, this is kind of very factual information on,
right.
on the CV. I think what we're interested in here at this particular point is more anecdotal things, like when I... talked to Dr. Neer, he brought up the point that one of his professors picked him out of his physics class after the third exam, you know, and started muscling him to go into physics, that kind of thing, rather than, I mean, this is information that's necessary, but what we're really interested in is the kind of personal, anecdotal...
Wondering is, this is going to go in some sort of archive someplace,
that's
right?
Correct.
Will this be included automatically?
Yes.
That's the point.
Yes.
I don't need to go over this because this is already a part of it.
Yeah. Right. All the documentation you sent me is the beginning of a file that will go with the transcript, and that'll all be supporting documentation.
Mm-hmm.
So mostly we want to discuss is the interactions and the things that you don't normally write about.
Are you picking up now?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we're recording information. So, you know, a lot of times you just don't talk about or put on in hard copy some of the influences that happened to you early in life or something like that. So, I don't know if, you know, you had any of those experiences during your education and background.
Well, let me start off with family background.
Yeah.
So we'll go through the...
Sure.
Through your outline here.
Mm-hmm.
It seems that most of the Lumpkin people were supposed to be school teachers. My parents, his brothers, sisters, their spouses were all public school teachers, and it seemed like they almost invariably went to Southwest Texas in San Marcos for school. So obviously Earl was expected to go there also to school. I've got one older brother or the younger brother. The oldest one is still alive. He's a chemist. In fact, the fact that he was a chemist and went to Southwest Texas persuaded me to go to Southwest Texas and take chemistry. Because when you are reared in the family of a school teacher in Texas during the Depression, you know very soon that you do not want to be a school teacher, because things were very, very difficult. Mm-hmm. Back in those days, my father was always a superintendent of schools or a principal of an elementary or a high school, and even in spite of fairly high level there, they still moved around. Now, these days, you go to work for a school district and you can spend an entire career at that one school district. Back in those days, you were elected by the board of trustees and you moved around. So as a result, I saw what the life of a school teacher was, and I did not want to be a school teacher. So when I enrolled in Southwest Texas, I deliberately took no courses in education so I could never ever be tempted to teach school. Let's see.
But why didn't you say that your older brother success in chemistry, interest in chemistry, influenced you to follow chemistry?
Yeah, because he also decided the same thing. Mm-hmm. He didn't want to be a school teacher. Neither did my younger brother want to be a school teacher. Mm-hmm. These three boys living in a school teacher's family during the Depression days, and always having a garden and raising chickens and having a cow and all the things that you need to do to get by on the school teacher's salary, just made us realize that we did not want to be in this profession. So as a result, I went to school to five different elementary and high schools during the time that we moved around, and I finally graduated from a relatively small high school, Hollandale High School in San Antonio, Texas.
Oh,
So I'm a Central Texas man. I guess the influential people, obviously, are my parents. The fact that they were educated. All of my forebears on my father's side were educated. And I learned from them the value of an education. In fact, my father, Charles Everett Lumpkin, his oration, this is what they called it in those days, his oration on graduation from Tyvee High School in Kerrville, Texas in 1912 was the value of an education. And I still got his handwritten copy of his oration that he gave to the senior high school graduating class in 1912. So it was always a given that all of us were going to go to college.
Okay.
But we might pursue
whatever you wanted.
Different areas. No, not wherever you wanted. I always wanted to go to the University of Texas. But finances were such that we ended up in San Marcos.
Okay, well, Texas is a state school, right? I mean, University of Texas. But there was just the problem of room and board. And
room and board and a place to live.
Yeah, and, okay. So it wasn't the cost of the education, per se. It was the cost of the living.
Right, I think back in those days, the state schools were for residents.
So if you had been able to stay with a relative or something like that, then it would have been, okay. So the cost of education was really the cost of living in that situation.
But let me tell you something about also was impressive to me. Now, back in the old days, I'm talking about the 1910 to 1925. An ambitious young man or woman graduating from high school with good grades could go to one summer normal school and the next fall start teaching in the public school systems. All right. So that means that my father started teaching school right after he graduated from high school, but he still wanted an education. So that means every summer, year after year, no matter where we were, he would pack up his family, come to San Marcos, rent a house or some rooms, go to summer school, get a few semester hours of credit, go back and teach at his school for the long term, come back to San Marcos again. So every year I went back and forth from where we were back to San Marcos again. And he finally got his Bachelor of Science degree. He started his teaching school down about 1918 and 1920.
Mm-hmm.
He finally got his bachelor's degree in about 1929, and he got his master's degree in about 1932. I even spent one summer in a tent in San Marcos on college property because he couldn't find a place to rent.
Yeah.
Well, that's
interesting.
That's my idea of impressing on a child the value of an education.
Yeah.
When the man will take his family, and they were three boys, though,
yeah,
take his family and just move them every summer.
Yeah, that does make a good impression.
So that's, again, one of the reasons why I went to Southwest Texas, and again, primarily it was financial.
So, but the interest in chemistry, that was, you just decided to kind of follow along on your older brother?
My older brother, that's right.
Didn't really have any burning desire, other than it looked like it was kind of, I mean, he seemed to be doing well with it, and you thought,
well,
you know, whether...
I guess I was interested in the scientific field as a kid. Gosh.
Okay.
When I was in the fifth grade and earlier, this was the days before, except people who had some affluence could purchase a radio.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So what does Earl do? He builds himself a crystal set radio.
Mm-hmm.
And there was an old gentleman named Algie Devaney, who lived in the little town of Martindale, just outside of San Marcos, about 7 miles, he would come by the school and he would sell us these galena crystals.
Mm-hmm.
And he would tell us how to make a crystal set radio.
Mm-hmm.
So all during my boyhood days, I was interested in, you know, in science and radio, electricity, and
mm-hmm.
things of this nature. This also obviously bent me towards the chemistry. In fact, when we moved from Martindale down to Oak Island, just below San Antonio, we moved into a teacherage which had no electricity in the home.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, this means kerosene lamps. By then we had a radio.
Mm-hmm.
We had no Atwater Kent radio.
Mm-hmm.
I wired the entire house, which was three bedrooms in the kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
I wired the entire house for a crystal set radio. I remember my Aunt Joseph gave me $15 for Christmas one year, and I went down and bought a pair of headphones. The rest of them had to listen through an old telephone receiver, it's,
mm-hmm.
you know, handheld
mm-hmm.
Earpiece.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So I set up the crystal set radio in my brother's and I bedroom, and I would run wires in a drop card, the old drop card ceiling,
oh, yeah. Yeah.
down where you could plug in these headphones. Everything was, or the receivers, everything was fine until you plug in about 4 or 5, then the signal got so faint.
Yeah.
And with that $15, I bought a variable capacitor. Finally, I was able to tune in WOAI and separate it from KTSA. Those mm-hmm. were both too strong.
Yeah,
San Antonio radio stations. Before it was kind of a mishmash, which one was the loudest signal you
yeah.
hear that.
Yeah.
So that's an interesting anecdote.
Yeah. Well, I remember when we I used to live in Laredo, and that was one of the things.
XCR down there.
Well, but Mutter got hung on WAI. We used to get that a lot, you know, at the right time of the day or evening or whatever. And so she always is a news buff, so I'm familiar with WAI because
right.
we used to listen to that all the time.
Let's see. So that's a lot of the reasons why I was involved in science. And while I was at Southwest Texas, I took practically every science course that they had there. In the field of
what kind of
physics, chemistry, mathematics.
Okay, so in other words, the curriculum was essentially that they had a lot of different science courses. Did they? I said, well, if you got a degree in chemistry, did they actually have a curriculum that had certain requirements for a chemistry degree, or did you just take a large spectrum of basic science courses with a little extra in chemistry?
Well, I took all the courses of chemistry that were offered, and so actually it was a Bachelor of Science degree.
Okay.
With a major in chemistry and a minor in physics and mathematics. And there were no great professors there. Dr. C.L. Key, I think, was probably my favorite chemistry professor.
Mm-hmm.
These were all doctorate type professors. It was, they were happy days, obviously, as an undergraduate there living at home. I was a townie, of course. I wasn't wasn't on campus a great deal.
So you were able to complete your education in a standard 4-year undergraduate.
After 3.5 years, because I live around town, so I went to school summer school also.
Sure.
Right.
As opposed to your dad, who just
he took
a long
25 years to get his education.
So basically, I'm sure in the chemistry there was, how modern was the chemistry? In other words, was it pretty much up to date with regard to the kind of tools you ended up using, or did they even mention them, or do you recall? Or?
Well, no. Now we're talking about
talking
about 1937 to 1941.
Okay.
Even though this is a teacher's college, they had very up to date laboratory apparatus.
Mm-hmm.
But mind you, now this is, nobody ever heard of a mass spectrometer in a college laboratory in those days.
Mm-hmm.
In the before World War I.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't have anything like what we call modern instrumentation. It was primarily wet chemistry.
Okay. So it was it was a good solid founding in chemistry, but it didn't give you any inkling of what you were going to get into.
Exactly. No. In fact, I had never heard of a mass spectrometer until I started to work for Humboldt and Refining Company. So then came almost 4 years of military service. I graduated actually in February 1941 because I had been to summer school, and now 1941, age 21. Obviously, this is the days of the draft, and I'm 1A, which means if my number comes up, I'm going to be in the military, and maybe in a role in the military that I didn't particularly care for.
Mm-hmm, I understand.
So I went to work for the Texas State Department of Health here in Austin, and there came a recruiting group from the Air Force through. So I took off a half a day, ate about 3 or 4 pounds of bananas in order to up my weight, because I only weighed about 135 pounds.
Sounds familiar.
And went down and took the physical exam and forgot about it. That was in July, and sure enough, in October I got greetings saying I was going to go to the Air Force, which was fine with me, rather than the infantry or something like that. So mm-hmm. I spent my military career in the Air Force. I went to UCLA in meteorology, took courses in advanced meteorology at UCLA.
So their interest in you was the fact that you did have a bachelor's degree. I assume that you graduated high in your class.
Yes.
So they wanted to continue your education in
a new field.
In a new field, but in something that they needed.
They needed everyone who came into the Air Force Meteorology, the early classes in the Air Force Meteorology School, all had to have science degrees.
Mm-hmm.
Before they even started into the meteorology.
Okay.
So
it's kind of like almost like a graduate study.
Right.
Program.
So this is a graduate course there, and I ended up in the Caribbean, South America, and then again took some additional graduate courses in meteorology at University of Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they set up a campus in San Juan, Puerto Rico.
Okay.
And I spent some months there.
Extension campus.
Exactly.
So. They just needed people to do weather forecasting, is that it?
Exactly.
To be weather-wise, or weather is perfect.
You know, if you understand the field of meteorology, yes, it is a science.
Yeah.
It's not an exact science like mathematics, but And there's some guesses involved, and we still know that, particularly when you're trying to forecast weather in South Texas. But I was forecasting weather in the tropics where it's a little bit more easy.
Was the state of the art of weather forecasting at that time? Did you try and get a clear 24-hour? I mean, obviously the military had interest in the weather. Was it mostly for flying in terms of being able to have clear weather days,
well,
knowing whether there was going to be a storm come in while you had a group of pilots out? Or
sure, all of that. Back when I graduated as a second lieutenant from UCLA, mm-hmm. in November 1942, the big push was getting planes over to North Africa, because this is when the invasion of North Africa happened in 42.
Mm-hmm.
And so they needed a lot of weather forecasters along the route from Miami down to Puerto Rico, on down to South America, on down to Belém in Brazil, across to Ascension Islands, then on across to Dakar in North Africa. So they got the 9th Weather Squadron had weather forecasters and weather stations stationed all along the route of ferrying warplanes over and war wearies back.
Sure.
So we're forecasting route information for
which is very critical, particularly for overseas flight, where if you have a problem, you got a problem.
Yeah,
you don't want to go on the drink.
And I was the base weather officer at most of my stations. I started off as being the only weather officer there, and then moved to another station, and had 3 or 4. By now I was a captain, and I had some second lieutenants under me, so I had pretty good sized operation.
Okay, so you really then this was your tour of duty during the war? Yeah,
41 to 45. So this cut into my education.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so what happens? By the end of the war, I already had 2 children. I was lucky. Odell got pregnant while we was in UCLA. She's out there with me. I got married at midterm during cadet school.
Mm-hmm.
And the good old Army Air Force, it wasn't the Air Corps, it wasn't the Air Force, it was the Army Air Corps. The good old Army Air Corps, every cadet who got married during school was immediately sent overseas. Those who did not get married were given stateside assignments near their hometowns. I was sent overseas.
Mm-hmm.
But I was able to make some trips back once in a while. So by the time the war was over, I had 2 children. I had to earn a living. I could no longer go back to school to complete my education.
Mm-hmm.
Here we are. But
you did have a bachelor's degree.
Oh yes.
And you had the postgraduate education in meteorology.
Yes.
And so you had intended actually to go on
in science.
In science and
exactly.
further graduate work. But now you have a lot of responsibility.
The Air Force wanted me to stay in as a career Air Force meteorologist, but I decided very quickly that I was not cut out to be an Air Force permanent career.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
as soon as the opportunity was available, back in those days you got out on points. What your age was, how many years or months of service, how many children you had. So I was one of the very first people who released, which was very lucky, because when I came back with my degree, I was probably one of the first ones who were able to come in and get a professional
mm-hmm.
job and beat most of the rest of the,
sure.
the
you were right
returning soldiers.
Yeah, you were
right.
The earliest back, so that was a good portion.
So my first look for a job, because I like the Central Texas area,
mm-hmm.
like in and around Austin. I went to the State Highway Department. I knew that they hired chemists, you know, asphalt and hardness and all this sort of business. They were not hiring. They says, sorry, not interested. And so I said, well, the next thing is Humble Oil and Refining Company. To me, Humble Oil and Refining Company was, you know, the big Texas oil company.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to Houston. And
this was mid-40s, then, 45, 40?
This was fall of 1945.
Okay.
Fall of 45. Went down and put in my application in the big old Humble building in downtown Houston. And they took my application and sent it out to the Research and Development Division in Baytown.
Mm-hmm.
And about a week later, I got a telephone call to come down to interview. And I went down and interviewed with them. I hadn't been discharged yet from the Air Force. I mean, I was on terminal leave. Mm-hmm. I was still in uniform with captain's bars and looking very, very neat and trim, etc.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And interviewed with the people at Humble R&D. And about 3 weeks later, I got a telephone call saying, yes, you're hired. So I went to work with Humble R&D Finding Company in the fall of 1945, and was immediately assigned to mass spectrometry.
Did they show that option to you as, you know, when you first interviewed, or was that, was that just...
Well, I took a general tour of the labs and saw the facilities, and I'm sure that they asked some penetrating questions about my knowledge of physics and electricity and magnetism and, mm-hmm. And electronics and things of this nature. And I don't think at the time that we interviewed they said, we want you for this specific job. But mm-hmm. when they called me and offered the job and I reported in, then they told me that I would be assigned to the mass spectrometry laboratory.
Mm-hmm.
There was one technical man in charge called, his name was Ben Thomas, B.W. Thomas. He was okay. The situation was that in about 1940, the first publication in you might say industrial mass spectrometry was a paper describing a consolidated mass spectrometer by Herbert Hoover Jr.
Mm-hmm.
And Harold Washburn. Okay, it turns out that they made an impression on a lot of petroleum people of what this instrument could do for the analysis of methane, ethane, propane, and actually be able to separate isonor and butane.
Mm-hmm.
So all the oil companies says, hey, this beats the old low temperature distillation procedure. We don't have one. So when I went to work for Exxon, I beg your pardon, Humble R&D Finding Company, later on Exxon,
mm-hmm.
later on Esso, then Exxon,
oh, yeah.
They already had a 21-101 mass spectrometer, and they also had a Westinghouse mass spectrometer. They were just setting up and getting together a group of people to exploit the use of these instruments. Because back in those days, gosh, we're talking about a recording oscillograph. You take the photographic paper and put it in a dark sleeve and go to a dark room and develop it and dry it. And then you've got people who go through and number the peaks on the oscillograph and measure the peak height, put this on a piece of paper. And then you went through an extensive calculation that CEC very tediously taught you how to do with beautiful manuals.
Mm-hmm.
And you had inverted matrices, and as time went on and we expanded all the way from hydrogen through the C5s, you ended sometime with 18 or 20 components in an inverted matrix. Okay? Now, how do you get these inverted matrices? What you do is you use an old Friedin or Marchant hand calculator, and it took about 2 or 3 days to invert a 20 by 20 matrix. And this, you could use this as long as the calibration data remained constant. Back in those days, the ionization chamber temperature was not controlled. It was very difficult to control the pattern and sensitivity of these various compounds, and we were analyzing for individual components,
mm-hmm.
not for types.
What was the highest component you know I looked at, the C4s or?
Well, with the 21-101, you could in one group, mixture, you could do hydrogen, CO, CO2, methane through the butanes, nitrogen, oxygen, H2S, water.
Okay.
Ethylene, propylene, isonor, the whole works.
Mm-hmm.
Finally, You were limited by the stopcock rigs, of course, and the volatility of the material.
Mm-hmm.
If you actually had a separated material, you could analyze for individual isomer pentane. You could analyze for individual C6s and the individual C4 olefins and C5 olefins.
Mm-hmm.
But not all in one big mixture.
Okay.
Had to have some separations. Shall I tell a story of the Westinghouse?
Yeah, I think so, because that was, well, first off, the CC machines were 180 degree magnetic
right.
sector instruments.
Yes.
Okay, and then Westinghouse was in the business, or got into the business. Do you know when they started? Or
how Westinghouse got in the business was when Harold Washburn and Consolidated Engineering Corporation began to sell these mass spectrometers to these very eager petroleum companies, and I'm sure a few chemical companies also bought these mass spectrometers. They made you sign a contract that any scientific breakthroughs that you made using this equipment would be assigned to CEC. The oil companies were in a bind. They signed the contract on the first instruments that they bought, but they said, we have to break this. So there was a consortium of people. Ben Thomas was one of them, John Hipple was one, I think Norman Cardishaw, maybe D.P. Stevenson from Shell and Emeryville. They went to Westinghouse, a famous electrical company, and says, hey, we need to build a mass spectrometer that we can buy instead of the CEC and break this this patent
mm-hmm.
business. So that's this group with me, and I may have some of the names wrong. I know that Ben Thomas is one of them.
Mm-hmm.
Finnegan may have been one of them. I'm not really sure. But anyway, they spent about 2 years in Pittsburgh with Westinghouse, and they came out with Westinghouse. That'll be 90 degree instrument. And again, when I went to work for Humble had two Westinghouse mass spectrometers. No, these were laborious instruments. I mean, this, you read the signal with the light beam galvanometer.
Mm.
You sat on it, and you the light beam would deflect, and you would null about balance it down to a null and read your K2 potentiometer to read the signal deflection.
Yeah, this sounds like a physics problem. You know, that's how Neer took a lot of his spectra.
Right.
By hand, the hard way. And this was still in 1945, even.
This is 45, 46. In fact, we used Westinghouse instruments clear up into the late 50s and early 60s. So we still using the Westinghouse. Because it was still a good, stable instrument. It had limited resolving power, 120. But with the compound, with the materials which you could vaporize at room temperature, that's all you needed anyway.
Yeah.
But you could vaporize and introduce through a gaseous inlet system till you got up into the liquids, and well, of course, you could put a little bit of liquid in and let it vaporize at room temperature, enough vapor pressure to read on a manometer.
Mm-hmm.
But when you got up into C6, C7, C8, you began to realize you have difficulties there. And so then, of course, what happened from there is you go into heated inlet system.
Mm-hmm.
You begin to realize that you need a heated inlet system.
Did the CEC instrument have a heated inlet system, or were they both essentially room temperature inlets? At
the 21-101 and the 21-102 were both room temperature inlet systems, gases only.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, people began to realize that if we heat up these inlet systems, get rid of the stopcock grease, I think Archie Hood and Jack O'Neill built an elevated temperature system.
So the problem with the stopcock grease is it would absorb compounds out of your sample mixture. So
so you got two things. First of all, you got absorption, so you got wrong results, and
mm-hmm.
second of all, you got memory effects for the next sample.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then there's always the menace of you got to shut down about a half a day every week, once a week, shut down, vent the entire system, and re-grease all your stock pumps. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, they begin to get draggy and leaky.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Oh, I wanted to say this about the stability of the spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
Normal butane was used to determine the sensitivity and the relative cracking pattern, like the 58 to 43 ratio, to determine what we call pattern,
mm-hmm.
the reproducibility of pattern. And when these change, well, then the analysis is off. And you mm-hmm. have to recalibrate for all these 20 gases or so. So CEC came out with a ionization chamber temperature controlling device. Have you ever seen one of these on a 21-101?
Mm.
It was a glass envelope in the first place. A glass envelope. In order to change filaments, you had to take the entire glass, the entire analyzer out of the magnetic field, break a wax seal, take out the ionization chamber, put in a new filament, insert the whole thing again. Well, anyhow, it was a glass portion of it, and on the outside of the vacuum, there was a parabolic mirror with a filament sitting in front of this, and there was a thermocouple on the ionization chamber. You try to maintain it slightly above what just the filament alone would maintain the temperature. So, of course, the thermocouple says, heat me up a little bit. A light would come on this parabolic mirror, which would shine through the glass envelope onto the ionization chamber, and it heated things back up again. It would take hours, it seemed like, for to reach temperature stability.
Mm-hmm. I can imagine.
So this was some of the early days. The stock cup grease and and wax.
So then the use of the inlet system, the heat inlet system, was kind of natural evolution to get
sure.
into to the heavier compounds.
You got all sorts of natural evolutions.
Yeah, and you wanted to get a heated ion source that was heated other than just from stray filament heating.
Right. So obviously, the as far as I'm concerned, the developments in mass spectrometry in the petroleum industry, and indeed probably throughout all of industry, started with CEC because they made the first instrument that was reproducible. Mm-hmm. Which I know that mass spectrometers were used before then for
sure.
isotope measurements and elemental atomic weights and things of this nature, but primarily it was just in the physics laboratory.
Mm-hmm.
This came into the chemistry laboratory now, when we finally got an instrument that had a reproducible pattern, and you could use it for actual analyses and identification of things.
Now, you were going to say something about the stability of the instruments, the fact that...
Finally, of course, CEC realized that they had to improve things, so obviously they did. So this is series of developments, not only in the resolving power, in the stability of magnetic fields, stability of electronics, recording devices. We finally got into digitizers instead of the old recording oscillographs. So there's the entire field just kind of moved along together, and in the petroleum industry it moved to higher and higher boiling ranges.
Mm-hmm.
I would say that probably the C8s and C9s are about as far as you could go for individual component analysis. And after that, you started into type analysis. In other words,
mm-hmm.
Total C5s, C6s, C7s, C8s, paraffins, naphthenes, aromatics, olefins, things of this nature. So
mm-hmm.
this started type analysis.
So the requirement for type analysis came from where, I understand the need for getting some analytical information about the various compounds, but the type analysis is giving you just more of a kind of a macroscopic view of what's out there. Type analysis was important, and for what reason?
Oh, sure, because now you've got to realize that the oil companies these days were... it was a harsh and buggy days as far as laboratory analyses of petroleum fractions, because petroleum is extremely complex, and the procedures that they used, anything that was better and gave them information that they needed, they would latch on to it. And they discovered that the mass spectrometer, they could take a a feedstock and run it through some sort of reforming process, look at the feedstock, look at the products, tell you that you've converted this much naphthenes to aromatics, this much high molecular weight paraffins into lower molecular weight olefins, all this sort of feed and product, studying pressures, temperatures, catalysis, and so forth. This is what we're involved in, and this is what the petroleum industry really used the mass spectrometer for.
So the type analysis really answered an even more important questions in the whole refining process.
Sure.
For
the only need for really individual component analysis in the lower boiling range is when you got into specialty products like toluene. If you're going to make a high grade toluene for nitration grade TNT, nitration grade toluene to make TNT, then you want to be able to analyze specifically for that component. Or if you're going to go into making good gasolines with a lot of iso-octane in it, you need to be able to measure the branchiness of the paraffins to get the high octane ratings. Otherwise, type analysis was the answer as you went to higher and higher boiling material. Mm-hmm. So the mass spectrometer was a glove that fit a needed hand.
The problem now with Westinghouse, they how long did they last? I mean, in a commercial business.
I don't think that Westinghouse really ever had their heart in making money at it. I think they did sell quite a few of them. We purchased two and we use them to good effect.
These were also 180 degree.
They were 90 degree.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. That's right. I did mention 90 degree.
90 degree sector.
I guess they had to avoid the 180 degree design to not infringe on CDC's design.
I'm not sure about that part of it. Let's see.
But they did work for the job.
Yes, they worked for the room temperature materials, which were had enough vapor pressure at room temperature.
And they also worked to break CDC's strangleholds.
Exactly. In fact, Frank Thiel and Sam Hastings used the Westinghouse for their work in publishing the first paper on low voltage analysis. They actually used the Westinghouse instrument for that. Mm-hmm. And that, of course, as far as Hummel and Exxon are concerned, the low voltage procedure, both at low resolution and high resolution, has been the mainstay of what our major contributions have been in characterization of petroleum. That is, just being able to identify and analyze for, I mean, quantitatively analyze for benzenes, naphthalenes, phenanthrenes, crisines, and all the way from C6 to C50,
mm-hmm.
And all of the aromatic oxidative compounds and nitrogen and sulfur compounds, identifying those and analyzing for those and being able then to tell the process people when they went through the different processes, this is what's happening in this process.
On the low voltage work that you mentioned, that was done when was it?
I think Sam Hastings and Frank Field's article came out in about 1956, and I published my first paper in 1958, and extended it. Theirs is very limited. They were not interested in the analytical field primarily. They were interested in showing the possibility of a technique.
Mm, okay.
And then I took it because we were in the same laboratory,
mm-hmm.
and extended it onto analytical procedures.
Now, your initial work when you first started working in this laboratory, what did you do? I mean, here you hired in, you walked in the door, and he said, "Here, or I'll get to work."
Well, the first thing they did was hand me the CEC manual. Says, start reading this and understanding this instrument and what it can do and how to do it. And
were there any other people? I guess there must have been somebody there who knew how to run it.
Oh, sure. Ben Thomas was there.
And were there other people?
We had instrument technicians. We always had great instrument technicians. We began to take on quite a load of work. I'm talking about finally running three shifts a day of people analyzing samples. Okay, when you talk about three shifts a day and reading all these charts and running the instruments and doing all the calculations, I'd be in a room, maybe a 20 by 40 foot room with 8 or 10 Freedom calculators and 6 or 8 women and men sitting there reading charts and running through calculations. So this was a big operation.
And then this was the way it was when you first got on board.
Yes, within a very few months, I mean, we were up and running, mm-hmm. but they needed technical help. Mm-hmm. Ben Thomas was by himself.
Yeah.
They needed technical help in supervising these people and understanding and keeping the quality control, doing what you were doing.
Sure.
Because although a lot of the people that we had Bachelor of Science, we very hardly hired anybody in as a research technician,
mm-hmm.
even without a bachelor's degree, which was good, of course, because they were high quality people.
Mm-hmm.
So I was lucky really to come in as a professional,
mm-hmm.
really.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. I was very lucky to have some people involved in the laboratories at Exxon that were greatly interested in the field of mass spectrometry. I'm sure you know Joe Franklin.
Oh, yes.
Joe Franklin was the first president of ASMS, for example.
Mm-hmm.
ASMS was organized in 1969. He was the first president. He was one of the men that I interviewed with in 1945.
Okay.
I went to work with him. And although he wasn't a mass spectroscopist, he was a scientist. One of his major interests was in the field of mass spectrometry. So he began to collect around himself, off and on over the years. Some came and some went, but over the years, of course, there was Joe Franklin and Frank Field, who was also a president of ASMS.
Mm-hmm.
There was Gene Futrell, who was also a president of ASMS. Fred Lamp. Bernie Munson, made quite a name for himself. Thomas Otzel, and myself. And a lot of these people would come and stay for a few years and then move on to some academic area. In fact, Joe Franklin himself left Humble and accepted the first Welch Foundation chair at Rice University.
Mm-hmm.
And he spent the rest of his career there. And Frank Field went to Rockefeller University.
Mm-hmm.
So we had quite a battery of people.
An impressive group, to be sure. One of the things that might be interesting to just track down for the record is this business. I know you mentioned Humble, Esso, and Exxon. You remember the dates and those changes and what the significance was? I mean, were there people? Was there merging of oil companies, or just a name change, or was somebody buying somebody out, or being bought? Or
yeah, well, Humble Oil Refining Company was founded about 1917 on the handshake of a few men in Humble, Texas. That's the reason why it's called Humble and not Humble.
Okay.
Humble. You pronounce the H. Humble, Texas. But apparently in the 1920s they needed some money for development, and they sold about 53% of their stock to John D. Rockefeller, Standard Oil Company. But they still maintained their independence as a Texas institution. They had agreements as far as in the research area. It was called the General Research Agreement. So there was an agreement between Standard Oil Development Company and Humble Research and Development Company on exchange of information. As the years went by, I think Standard Oil Company began to realize, hey, here is a valuable piece of property. We ought to buy some more of it. So they began to buy more and more stock of Humble Oil Refining Company. I owned Humble Oil Refining Company shares. I didn't own any Standard Oil Company shares for many, many years. And finally, in in 1953, Standard Oil began to buy up more and more Humble stock. And in about 1965, they acquired enough of the Humble stock that they could declare it. They got over 95% or something like that. Some legal way, they said, okay, we can now call in all the rest of it. So they gained 100% control of Humble in about 1965.
Okay, and so relatively recently then.
Yes. Yeah. And then we became SO Research and Engineering Company. They changed the name from Standard Oil Development Company to SO Research and Engineering Company. This is the research part of Standard Oil.
Mm-hmm. SO being abbreviation for Standard Oil.
SO, exactly. Yeah. And then in about 1970, they changed the name to Exxon because they were having trouble marketing under Esso in two or three states. I think Illinois was one of them, and Kentucky or Tennessee was one of them. That when the Standard Oil Company, the old Rockefeller Company was broken up in 1911. There was an antitrust action, and they broke up the Standard Oil Empire, and they went to Saucony Vacuum was one of them, and Standard of Indiana was one of them, and Standard of California, and all the Standard companies were broken up, and Standard of Ohio. And
so I guess where do we stop?
Well,
you essentially just started working kind of at.
I think we finished up.
Yeah,
the early days,
the early part of Humboldt.
Are you going now?
Yeah.
Okay. Let me tell you something about the organizational area of Humble.
Yes, I think that's important.
And later of SO and Exxon. When I hired in as a physicist because I was working in the area of physics, of course. And it wasn't long after that they changed the name to chemists and research chemists and things of this nature.
So they classified the mass spectrometry as physics or treated as
primarily
physics. Okay. Well, I mean that makes sense.
But within about 2 years, they just dropped that altogether. They always had a parallel ladder, a professional and administrative, so that people could by choice stay in the professional ladder or just say, hey, I'd like to be an administrator and go along in that field. So this was a field that I stayed in the technical field, in the administrative field. And I imagine that a lot of good mass spectroscopists all over the country were promoted into the administrative area, and we lost them from mass spectrometry, really.
Yeah.
And maybe one of the reasons why I stayed so long in the field of mass spectrometry was because of the fact that maybe I didn't have good administrative skills and was never tapped to go into the administration, but remained in the in the professional field. And Joe Franklin did the same thing. He stayed in the professional ladder. And Thomas Otzel stayed in the professional ladder. And Frank Thiel stayed in the professional ladder. He never became an administrator. Well, except for maybe one or two aides or something like this.
Mm-hmm.
But I think an important thing about Humboldt was the fact that they had a program for personal development. This was called the Humboldt Lectures in Science series. Again, this is one of Joe Franklin's ideas. Every year or every 2 years, he would form a series of courses. He would contact people from all over the world, top people in their field, to teach graduate courses in the selected fields, and technical people could sign up for these courses. They consisted of 2 or 3 weeks of intensive work at the graduate level, representing a semester of work.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And while you're taking these courses, you're relieved of all other duties. You don't have to check into the office, you don't have to answer any correspondence or any telephone call or anything else. You're relieved of all other duties during this period. So I want to just read off to you some of the courses that I took and some of the people's names that you'll recognize of the courses that I took in the Humboldt Lectures in Science series. The Spectra of Polyatomic Molecules by Dr. K.S. Pitzer, University of California, Kenneth Pitzer. General Physical Chemistry, Dr. F.A. Matson, University of Texas. Modern Theories of Organic Reactions, Paul Bartlett of Harvard. The Chemical Bond, Linus Pauling, University of California. Free Radicals in Photochemistry, Canadian National Research Council, E.W.R. Stacey. Electronic Circuits, Robert Watson from Texas A&M. Mathematics, Professor B.C. Moore from Texas A&M. The Chemistry of Organic Sulfur Compounds, Dr. F.G. Bardwell from Northwestern. Free Radicals in Solution, Dr. Chavis Walling from Columbia University. Electronics for Chemists, University of Illinois. I forget the professor there. Estimation of Physical Properties, Dr. R.C. Reed of MIT. Free Radical Chemistry, Professor Michael Swartz from Syracuse University. So this was a great thing for continuing education and self-improvement.
How many people would typically take these courses?
They were limited by the size of the classroom, and generally 10 to 15 people.
And these were all worked for at Baytown? Or?
Yes. I beg your pardon. We would have some people come from the Houston office. We would have some people from Technical Service Division, which was actually the technical side of operating the refinery, as well as Research and Development Division. And these were courses where you whip the class like 3 hours in the morning, took a noon break, and 3 hours in the evening, and assignments for the evening, and a final examination with a grade.
Oh, whoa.
Yes.
So you got a grade.
Oh, yes. You went through the whole works like you were in university.
I see.
Special textbooks. And back up my technical library in there right now is about half made up with all the books from these people.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, they would send their textbooks, or their selected textbooks, either they had written themselves or the ones that they wanted for use in their courses.
And this took place over a period of how many years?
Well, my first one was in 1947, and my last one was in 1964.
So for quite a long time.
That's what it was.
17 years.
Years.
Yeah.
Right.
So
I took courses every year, every other year. It's according to what was going on in your particular field, and whether you were the powers that be thought that you would be helped by taking this course.
And Franklin was the...
He was the dean.
Of the school,
right,
so to speak.
He would make the arrangements.
I see.
And what is normally during the course of the school, two of the students, together with Joe Franklin, and the professor would go out for lunch.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next day, two more students and Joe and the professor would go out to lunch someplace else. And we'd end up on Friday night on the last week of the course is a big banquet held someplace in Galveston or in the big Hummel building in downtown Houston or someplace in Baytown, but whatever. But I was going to tell you this anecdote.
Okay.
The day that was my turn to take Linus Pauling for lunch, we went to the old Rebel Inn in Baytown. For lunch, obviously, you don't go there for them.
Yeah.
Mrs. Pauling was having lunch with us also. And we went in to order, and I think we had some canapés in advance, something like this, and there were some jalapeno peppers. Okay. Now, Mrs. Pauling is not afraid of jalapeno peppers. She lives in California, in Southern California, and she's used to not Southern California, Central California. She's used to jalapeno peppers and Mexican food and things of this nature. No troubles. She picked up one of these things. I says, Mrs. Pauling, they're quite hot. She says, oh, no trouble. She bit down into it, and it seemed like she could not breathe for about 30 seconds. We began to be frightened. Finally, she got it out of her mouth, and she gasped, and she choked, and she spluttered, and finally grabbed a glass of ice water. But she didn't have any more.
So she was not quite ready for anything quite
she
that
She wasn't
hot.
Quite ready for a real Mexican jalapeno
pepper.
Right. And when the Friday evening banquet came, it just turned out that Odell and I were sitting at the table with Dr. and Mrs. Pauling. I very courteously did not mention this at all.
Yes. Well, she, I guess she was just visiting them for...
She was just down there for the 2 weeks, and I'm sure that Mildred Franklin toured her around all over the area.
Now, the administration, the company, obviously bought into this package pretty much. I mean, you're saying this is a 3 week exercise each
time? Yeah, two to 3 weeks.
And you're talking full time?
Yes.
It's not a thing where you do it for
the top, top people in their field, all over, from any place. So they were probably paid a pretty good, hefty remuneration.
Well, not to mention the fact that you guys weren't working either.
That's right.
And you were being paid to take this course. If Franklin had any trouble with that activity up the ladder?
No, as far as I know, he was very respected. And humble higher-up administrative people, I think, realize very much the value of scientific research.
Mm-hmm.
They wouldn't have bought mass spectrometer in the first place if they didn't realize that, hey, we can come out here. And I guess I had been there for 45, about 1949 or 1950, I got a section head. Says, look, we've been doing all this beautiful work for 3 or 4 years, and we're not publishing. Let's start publishing. So all of a sudden, myself and Ben Thomas and mass spectrometry and people in infrared and separations and UV, and we began to publish.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's one of the reasons why Humble Baytown R&D Analytical became, you know, fairly well known in its field.
Why, frequently when, a chemical company goes to publication, they tend to be somewhat restrictive in what's published. Was that the situation in your case? Or
it always had to be reviewed, and you had to be selective in examples that you made. In the analytical field, you always like to take an example of a feed in a product that shows what happened to in the process that is of some value to the company. So, yes, they looked at it carefully.
And but they didn't.
But they did allow things.
They did allow things. Did they? Frequently, what will happen in some situations is publications go out, but then they're delayed by such a large amount because of bureaucratic holdups.
No.
So if you submitted a paper for review, it was done in a timely fashion.
A lot of times it was done right there in Baytown. Occasionally, something would have to go up to New Jersey for approval. But most of the time, the patent people right there in Baytown would make the decision, hey, there's nothing in here that first to be released.
What types of journals then did most of these articles go into? The Journal of Physical Chemistry or
Analytical? Well, most of what I was involved in went into Analytical Chemistry. Mm-hmm. But, hey, I know that you can't see this on the tape recorder, but I'm showing Mike a bound volume called Earl Lumpkin on Mass Spectrometry, which was presented to me when I retired in 1980. Mm-hmm. Well, what happened was that the publications that I was author or co-author of over the years, I'd get reprints of when possible. Mm-hmm. And I had some in a drawer, and apparently one of my colleagues came in one time and sneaked one copy of
each one out.
Each of these things out, and they
ended bound up, it for you.
They ended up by being in this beautiful bound volume.
I see.
So
here gives you a good idea then. Of
yeah, here's Analytical Chemistry. Here is Journal of Chemical Physics. This is Joe Franklin. Here's one Journal of the of Chemical Physics. Here's one Journal of the American Chemical Society. And chemistry. Another one, Journal of the American Chemical Society. Mostly analytical chemistry.
Okay. Did you have, so these are all review journals and all that kind of stuff, and you'd have to deal with people sending back reviews and trying to answer their questions.
Oh, yeah. But never major difficulties. Hardly ever did we have to do much changing.
So the decision to go ahead and publish the work was made more or less at a fairly low level.
At the time, when I thought I had something of value that I would like to have other petroleum mass spectroscopists know about, I would just write it up and submit it to my boss, and he'd say, sure, I'll go ahead and publish it.
Okay.
Actually, the way Humble operated was not a major hands-on from up above. But we were really quite free to pursue whatever direction at whatever pace that we thought was correctly. Mm-hmm. I can recall many, many sessions where your boss comes in once a month for a sit down for an hour to talk about things. Mm-hmm. He wouldn't be telling me what to do. I would be telling him what I had been doing. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And this is the type of.
So you really had a great deal of freedom.
Exactly. Yeah. This is the type of administration that was going on. It's great.
And how long did this go on? I mean, for all of your.
It went on I spent 3.5 years with Exxon Production Research Company in Houston. Otherwise, I was in Baytown all of my career.
Okay.
I went in there as a section head. And there, again, we had mass spectrometry. Another side of mass spectrometry, that is isotope ratios, carbon-12, carbon-13 ratios for geologic work. And we had potassium-argon age dating with the mass spectrometer, releasing argon, melting the rock, etc. Mm-hmm. We realized this. And so I spent 3.5 years there. After Thomas Otzel came to work with Hubble, Thomas came in 1959, and I spent 1965 to 1968 with Exxon Production Research Company in Houston. And then when Prudhoe Bay oil field was discovered in about 1967, I guess it was,
they became
a big push on mass spectrometry in Baytown, and so I was transferred back into mass spectrometry in Baytown.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I was Thomas Oxel's office mate. We were office mates for off and on for many, many years. Had a great relationship. Let me tell you this story. Thomas was a big man. I mean, physically.
Mm-hmm.
But he had very little manipulative abilities as far as laboratory is concerned. He was an idea man and handled data, but he didn't handle equipment or instruments. He knew which end of a screwdriver to grab a hold of, but that was about the extent of it. I mean, he was not proficient with his hands. Okay, we were office mates. I got the I'm sure you've seen these rolling swivel chairs that you can rotate a little collar down here and lift the chair up and down to various heights.
Okay.
So we got new chairs and we set them both just at the right height. And about a year later, I got the idea, I think I'll begin to move Thomas's chair up a little bit. So about once a week, I would take a hold of his collar and move it up about an eighth of an inch. And next week, I'd move up the chair about an eighth of an inch. So his chair is getting higher and higher. And finally, he's coming in trying to sit at his desk, and he's having to spread his legs as wide as he could because he couldn't get his knees under his desk any longer. And so he doesn't know what to do. I really suspect that he knew that I was doing it, but he very calmly says, Earl, he says, I think my chair is too high. Would you please lower it for me? And so I very calmly says, yes, Thomas, it does seem to be a bit high. So I rolled it back down to where it was before, and he never said a word about it except that.
He must have suspected somebody was playing.
Oh,
here,
yeah, right. Well, he didn't. It happened so gradually that he just all of a sudden, wham.
He couldn't get
under
his desk.
He couldn't get under his desk. But anyhow, that was not very kind of me to do something like that to somebody like Thomas. He was so sincere and so naive, you might say.
Mm-hmm.
But I did. Let's see. What else do we need to cover?
Well, let's see. Do you have any more that with regard to the work environment? I think we have a pretty good feeling for the fact that, you know, the petroleum industry.
Right.
It was very forward-looking, and I guess I get asked this: Do you feel that Exxon now has the same attitude towards the scientific pursuit and the people working in the scientific
areas today? Exxon may not have quite the open attitude that Humboldt had. Because it seems like that whenever Humboldt R&D division wanted a piece of capital equipment, and now don't forget, something like an MS-9 or an MS-50 is a piece of capital equipment. I mean, we got the first MS-9 in the country in 1963. That was $100,000, plus all the training, plus sending me on a 3-week trip over to England to get trained out on it and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
But there was, from my point of view, there was no major effort in setting this because of the fairly good things that we had done with the older CECs and the Westinghouse National Spectrometer. So that finally, when we began to realize as we went further and further into the barrel, higher and higher boiling ranges and more complex materials, that we had to have more resolving power, that Humboldt bought it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they bought the first MS-9, but we told them, hey, in order to further understand the character of petroleum, we had to have more resolving power. So
So there was a definite interest in doing the analytical work, or knowing that it had to be done. There was people in high enough positions in the company that this was, it wasn't, you didn't have to go through a lot of hoops and whatnot to justify this.
No, we wrote a one-page justification, and something that much would go up to New Jersey, and about 2 weeks later come back down approved, and we brought out a purchase order. Nugent Chamberlain bought a big fancy nuclear magnetic resonance spectrometer. I mean, we had the top line of equipment in a petroleum research laboratory because of the fact that Humboldt was willing to bet on its scientists. The fact that we could get the information. In fact, just think of the work of Franklin and Field on ion molecule reactions. There's practically nothing there for the oil company as far as making money. It's advancement of the knowledge of chemistry that Field spent practically a career in the area of ion molecule reactions and protonation of ions and so forth, that is now big throughout the industrial and the academic area. He started that there in Baytown. He built his own mass spectrometer. Well, he had a machinist in Houston built his chemical physics mass spectrometer according to his design. Now, what is there in that for Humboldt as far as process development? Anything? Nothing. It was the advancement of the knowledge of chemistry.
So they were willing to foot the bill for that, though.
Right, exactly. Right. And provide a big lab, research and laboratory technicians, and all that's required to do this. He finally moved it to, Exxon gave it to him when he moved to Rockefeller University. He took it with him. And Exxon, now, they've now closed out the analytical laboratories in Baytown. I'm talking about 1992. There are some analytical labs, but not the big analytical research and development lab that we had there from the 40s through the 80s, which was about 85, 86. But Exxon Research has their own major research organization in New Jersey now, of course, and they're still backing up research in all fields, not only mass spectrometry, all fields in New Jersey. Not very much more in Baytown. Let's see.
So when you started out between the 101, which was a silographic light beam with a photo paper, and and the Westinghouse, which was even more primitive, you moved on all the way through machines like MS-9 and
MS-9, MS-50.
Okay.
You obviously, when you start, as time goes by, as instrument manufacturers make more complex instruments and better instruments that turn out more and more data, where are you going to end up? Computers, obviously. We end up with computers, so we all enter into the field of computer handling of data initially. We were still getting the data by hand, you might say, and punching cards and sending the punch cards into a computer. That started off that way. And then finally you got computers to actually get the data directly from the instruments. And so I was all the way through the field, clear up into the days of where you had a dedicated computer on a high-resolution mass spectrometer. And we ended up by, it seemed like the last several years that I was there, that I was more of a computer man than a mass spectroscopist. Because primarily, the data was coming forth from the MS-50 in such abundance. We were trying to make heads and tails of what all of these spectra meant, that you would write computer programs to boil it down to some things that the engineers that you're doing this work for For instance, we would analyze crude oils from all over the world,
mm-hmm.
and the engineers want to know, well, what components does this crude have in it different from this? Should this go into a lubricating oil, or should this go into making gasoline, or whatever? What should we do with these various crudes? How should we classify them?
Mm-hmm.
And so you end up with these thousands and thousands of bits of information that you get off of a mass spectrometer, and try to reduce it to maybe 10 little indices.
Mm-hmm.
An index that determines this, and that. It can tell the man what he wants to know. So you write computer programs to reduce this mass of data into down to some usable information for the engineers.
So there's you really kind of spanned a fairly broad gamut of technical development in the instrumentation itself, all the way from essentially unheated or unregulated
heated
sources and detectors that required even a lot of manual labor just to get the data out, all the way through computers. You mentioned Thomas was not a, you know, not an experimentalist. Were you a hands-on, knob-twisting type?
Yes, I was in the laboratory. I was primarily an experimentalist. Anytime there was any difficulty with any machine, Earl was the man who made decisions on what to do.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I suspect that one of the reasons why I'm fairly meticulous at things that I do now in my own little workshop out here is the fact that I was working on $100,000 machines, and I didn't want to goof things up, and you had to take things pretty slow and pretty easy when you're cleaning up an electric sector, or and you don't want to break these quartz pieces and things like this. So yes, I was strictly a hands-on, and I developed a lot of the things that were used. I published a diagram of a solids inlet system, for example,
mm-hmm.
a high temperature solids inlet system. Before then, there was major difficulties in getting solids into an instrument. Okay, what can you do? You put it in solution, and then put it in. You got all the solid in there, unless it can boil it off and then vaporize. Or you try to melt it and it sublimes on you before, etc. Terephthalic acid is a good one. Nobody could get a spectrum of terephthalic acid. You try to heat it up to melt it, get it into your little micropipette, and the stuff is solidified before you could get it into a gallium-covered frit.
Mm-hmm.
So I built the solid unit system and got a beautiful spectrum of terephthalic acid and a lot of other things.
Mm-hmm.
This featured a glass and ball, dry glass and ball, valve, glass and ball socket, no stopcock grease, completely dry, polished, days, till you finally could take them out in the sunlight and put the socket over the ball, and you could see interference fringes. It was so close, and then you could close that valve and open an atmosphere across that valve, and just close an atmosphere across this dry ball and socket valve. Okay. Must have been about 1958 or 60, I made a trip out to California to visit CEC. This is when they were just beginning to work on the 21110 Metalc double focusing mass spectrometer, and we had signed a contract to buy one. And so New Jersey had signed a contract to buy one. We're going to buy two, one from them and one for us down here. And so we were out there talking about it one time, and I can recall being in the CEC research laboratories and talked about an inlet system for this instrument that they were designing that would have resolving power of 5,000.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So I went to the blackboard and I drew this diagram, just a chalk diagram of an inlet system with which you could introduce gases liquids and solids with a 1-inch pump-out valve on it. Part of it enclosed in a heated chamber, part of it not enclosed in a heated chamber.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So after the conference was over with the scientists and so forth who were around, that drawing was on the blackboard. About 2 years later, I heard that drawing that I made on the blackboard stayed there for months and months. And finally, when CEC came out with their next advanced instrument, there was my index system.
Mm-hmm. What do you put on the blackboard?
Right, right. Of course, we had already built one like a year before.
Yeah.
We never bought an instrument with the index system. I say never. The first few CECs. Later CECs and the MS-9 and the MS-50, we told them, don't ship it with the index system. We will provide our own index system.
That's it.
So, when the first MS-9 came over in 1963, they shipped it with their Emmett system because they insisted it passed the specification test with their Emmett system. We said, okay, when your man finishes, we take it off, we send it back to you with credit for the cost of that, and we install mm-hmm. our own. So they said, fine.
Mm-hmm.
When the MS-50 came over, they didn't even send the Emmett system. We had one that already made to go on it by the time we got here.
So,
I was hands on with a lot of things like that.
Yeah, and this whole business related to the fact that you wanted to probably get into higher temperatures and to higher microweight materials
sure.
than the mass spec designer in the system designer
right.
had come up.
Well, they ended up with fairly good in the systems, most of the manufacturing people. Because I was only involved with the CEC and mm-hmm. AEI and Westinghouse. Of course, that was way back. So I was much, very much of a lab, hands-on person. All sorts of things. I mean, separation procedures, silica gel, lumen gel, percolation fractions. If you look through the publications that I was involved in, is mm-hmm. I did an awful lot of separations, and later on we got into gas chromatography, combination with mass spectrometers. I was involved in that, and writing our own computer programs. In the latter few years, when mass spectrometers were had a dedicated computer program of their own, we used the computer program provided for us only for data acquisition. For handling of the data on down the line, we wrote our own program.
Yeah.
We just take the data,
sure.
feed it into a tape, read off and select the masses that we wanted to do what we wanted to do with them, and ended up with, I'm sure you've heard some of our papers.
Oh yeah,
that Thomas and I presented mm-hmm. in the 70s and 80s.
So basically, you did a lot of the work that currently or even at the time was done by the vendor. You actually were more advanced, and you were actually doing things that were different than perhaps they had anticipated with their general purpose instrument systems and software.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah, for instance, take the business of low voltage, where you really are stressing a filament.
Mm-hmm.
Trying to get enough ion current, and electron current across the ionization chamber. We would work with people, tell them what we needed, and they would make suggestions or make changes in their filament assemblies in order to put on additional electrodes on the ionization chamber in order to give more constant electron voltages and get more electron current.
Yeah.
So we would tell the manufacturer what we needed and make suggestions on how to do this. We're not manufacturing hardware.
Right.
Like DuPont did for a while. But,
mm-hmm.
But we would suggest to them what some additional things that could be done with the instruments if they would do this and that.
Sure. And they saw that it was to their own advantage to
yes.
take these suggestions to heart.
Well, I don't know if there's any other aspects of the technical part of the work that you know want to discuss. I think we've covered quite a bit.
I think so too, but I.
If you have some notes you want to refresh there, okay. Yeah, we'll just take a break here.
Hey, Ian, had something.
Well, I was thinking here, yeah, that's good in the CV, but I would, you know, you've been pretty intimately involved with the American Society for Mass Spectrometry over the years, and its predecessor, ASTM.
Exactly.
And I think there's a lot of ASTM activities or history that has kind of maybe is in danger of slipping through the cracks. It might be worthwhile spending a little bit of time here discussing ASTM from your experience with it when you first got involved, what the people were doing, and important things that you saw in its development.
Yeah, that might be a good idea. Let's see, coming up in 1992 is the 40th annual conference. Okay, it's not 40 years of ASMS.
No.
What they're doing is they're backing up to when ASTM E14 started.
Yeah.
In 1952.
Yeah.
Okay. But as far as I'm concerned, then you're going to back up even further than that, back to 1946. I went to my first mass spectrometry conference in Houston. Incidentally, that's one of the reasons why I got this list of trips that I sent you.
Yeah.
It's always a great reminder to me to know where these meetings were held and when they were held,
sure,
etc. And when I start looking through these things, I realize that I attended every mass spectrometry conference from 1946 until I retired. I did not miss a one. It was back in the 40s, late 40s, it was called the CEC group meeting.
Mm-hmm.
And this was the forerunner of ASTM E14. They had a meeting each year, and ASMS is still following the same format, that is, East, Midwest, West, East, Midwest, West, or Midwest or South, either one.
Mm-hmm.
And so this went on from 19. Actually, the first one was held in 45, and I didn't get to go because I wasn't working.
Sure.
At the time. This went on until 1952, and CEC would announce the meeting and invite people to give papers, technical papers, if they wished to. And it was kind of like a half technical conference, half clinic. Whereas obviously it was their meeting and they introduced new concepts and new calculation procedures and new hardware, etc. And this went on for, as I say, until 1952.
Now these were like 1 day, 2 day, 3 day meetings, parallel sessions.
They were generally two to 3 day meetings.
Initially.
Right. Let's see. In 1947, it was held in Los Angeles, California, and I went out there from the 13th to the 19th. I don't think all that 6 day was all a meeting. I'd have to look at the calendar to see where that was.
No,
but anyway, there were several day meetings. It wasn't just a 1 day meeting, it was several day. It was worth making a trip to California or New York or Pittsburgh or wherever you went to for the meeting. And it was generally worthwhile, and I was always the technical man who went and got a lot out of it. Mm-hmm. Obviously, the company thought so too. They wouldn't have sent me.
Sure.
Because we learned about new products and new ways of doing things, and we also learned what other people in the field were doing, because we were giving technical presentations. I mean, D.P. Stevenson from Shell Emeryville would talk about his ionization appearance potential measurements and what he was learning from those things, and
mm-hmm.
Archie Hood from Shell and Deer Park would talk about procedures that he used, and Ralph Brown with Atlantic Refining Company would talk about things that he discovered with the mass spectrometer. So they were really forerunners.
Do you feel that the other petroleum companies had, where there were competitors, had as much invested in the scientific, in the pursuit of scientific information as Humble Research and Development? Or?
There were, I think that by and large, we felt that we were along the top. I think that we thought major competitor is, was Shell Emeryville, California.
Mm-hmm.
I think we thought that we were ahead of most everyone else as far as the development in the field. But there were, you know, there were people active in American Oil Company, Pan American Oil Company, Shell, there was an oil company, General Petroleum in Torrance, California, Atlantic in Philadelphia.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was, but it turned out, of course, that a major number of these oil companies were in Texas.
Sure.
So we found out there were a lot of Texans going to these meetings.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess it was, must have been 50 or 51 in, no, before then, late 40s, in the Jung Hotel in New Orleans, on Canal Street, okay? And CEC's putting on the, they put the bill for the Wednesday evening banquet, mm-hmm. or the end of the conference banquet, whichever it was at that time. And they hired a girl to play on a stomach Steinway, an accordion, some songs.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, this, how many people in attendance to the conference? Maybe 25 or 30 people, something like that. Well, half of them Texans. And so we stand around and sing songs after a beer or two. We sing all kinds of songs. Oh, My Darling Clementine, the whole works.
Mm-hmm.
And we always end up by singing The Eyes of Texas as the last song that we sing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
I wonder why.
Well, there was nothing had to do with the University of Texas. It was just the fact that we were all Texans, whether you went to Skidoo University of Texas or any place,
mm-hmm.
that was one song that everybody in Texas knew, whether they went to the University of Texas or not. So it was just a song that we all had in common. And so it became a commonplace thing that we would sing this. So this went on all through the days of the CEC conferences.
Mm-hmm.
And it then in 1952, a lot of the powers that be began to realize that, hey, meanwhile, Westinghouse started their own separate annual conference,
mm-hmm.
and CEC began to see that this is getting too big and too expensive for us to carry this on. Let's put it under somebody else's wing. So in 1952, it was decided to hold the CEC group meeting at Pittsburgh. This is when the Pittsburgh meeting was still being held in Pittsburgh.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we went to the Pittsburgh Conference in 1952, and we all met in one little low-seating room someplace. It must have been about 50 people there. A hot room, a lot of cigarette smoke going on, and we were talking about whether or not we want to join this group called ASTM. Now, most of us had never heard of ASTM. Even though I had been working in the petroleum industry, you know, there's somebody that publishes technical papers, but not in the field of mass spectrometry.
Yeah.
And there was a man there from ASTM, says, hey, look, we'll form our own committee, and we'll let y'all can practically be on your own. You won't even know that you're tied to ASTM. We'll just let you form your own little technical group. So it was decided at that meeting in 1952 that we would, CEC would drop their group meetings, but they would still help and be involved and sponsor mm-hmm. things in the field of ASTM E14. So this committee was formed in 1953. We met again at Pittsburgh. This time it was the first. Maybe 52 was the first one. Not that one. You know, which one they decided was first.
Yeah. Then,
at this time, it was now 14. And so this is one of the reasons why we now, in 1992, we go back 40 years to 1952.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because that was when E-14 was formed, and they began to call the conferences E-14.
So was there at the time, were there some possible other options besides the STM? Were you thinking maybe of going with the Pittsburgh Conference or?
I think Pittsburgh Conference offered that possibility. Mm-hmm. In fact, we went there for 2 years in a row. But most of us did not like the idea of going to Pittsburgh in whether February or whatever
right.
it was. We liked the idea.
Good thinking.
Of, hey, sunny California, San Francisco, Denver, Atlantic City, Atlanta, going around these various places. And by then, some of us were taking our wives with us, and we could treat them to the various places all over the country. So we said, no, we don't want to be involved with the Pittsburgh Conference. And so we went to ASTM, and I think it was a fairly happy marriage.
Mm-hmm.
Later on, of course, the people primarily in academics didn't like the idea of being tied in with ASTM, which is a standards organization. And so finally in 1969, right, when ASTM E14 was formed.
I don't know the dates that well myself. I was there, but...
Right. ASMS in 1969 in Dallas. I rely on my memory for this. And people began to talk about, hey, we got an awful lot of academic people coming into it now, and mass spectrometry has just evolved into so many areas away from procedures, which is what ASTM... primarily would be involved with, except for this very special group of people, and they didn't bother themselves. They didn't push us to write procedures or anything. They just let us go our own way and collect our own monies and elect our own officers, and once in a while report to them. I was secretary of ASTM 14 for a couple of years, and then later on I was, after ASMS was formed, I was chairman of ASTM E14 for a couple of years, but there was always a good relationship, finally, I think primarily because of the fact that mass spectrometry just grew so big, went into so many different divergent directions of biologics and extraterrestrial, or looking at meteorites, and it just evolved into so many different things that it had nothing to do with the standards organization at all, that we decided to form our own own society. Of course, I was a charter member. I was there in 1969, and I voted for Joel Franklin to become the first president of ASMS. We started in 69, and I've maintained my charter membership ever since then.
Joe is at Rice now?
No, Joe's dead now.
Yeah, I mean in 1969, when he was elected as the was he at Rice or
no? He was still with Humble.
Okay,
Exxon.
So he went to Rice somewhere.
He went
after
to Rice after that. Oh. Yes, he was still at Baytown.
Yeah,
and he went on there. Well, I was just telling you about this Eyes of Texas business. Do you want to hear that again?
Oh yeah, yeah.
Okay, because I wrote it up once for the ASMS Journal, but somebody look into these archives and not ever see that.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah. I mentioned a while ago that this proliferation of Texans in the CEC group meetings and later on ASTM E14, we got into a habit of deciding that we had to, even if we couldn't sing songs all evening long, we at least had one song, so we would sing the Eyes of Texas. So every Wednesday evening during the group meetings and the conferences, we would arrange to meet on Wednesday evening just before the banquet in a certain corner of the building, and all the buzz is going on, of course, from the cocktail hour, and you can hardly hear yourself, but finally there might be a little faint music show up in one corner of the room, and here we are all gathered together singing the Eyes of Texas. And this kept on until I retired. The last conference.
with the eyes of Texas.
Okay, yeah, I was saying that in the midst of all the hubbub of the cocktail hour before the annual Wednesday night banquet, there would be a faint rendering sometimes, according to how many voices we had available. Texas were beginning to get kind of thinned out. Some of them were kind of shy. Frank Field never sang with us. But Joe Franklin did. Joe Franklin would sing The Eyes of Texas with us. And finally we began to recruit some good, strong voices. Let's see. I've got that down here someplace. Oh, John Bynum was one of them. John Bynum could sing a good song, and he learned the words real fast. So we would make him an honorary Texan. So John Bynum sang with us for several years, and Fred McLafferty sang with us for several years. He had a good lusty voice also. Joe Franklin's voice was kind of squeaky.
Yeah, I remember that.
He knew the words obviously because he was a graduate of the University of Texas.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was good as long as he lasted, but he wasn't very strong. Well, then we would always arrange to have this little meeting of the singing of the Eyes of Texas very close to the doors that would open up then into the banquet room from the cocktail room, so that we, when the doors opened, we would have our choice of tables.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a twofold procedure for this. We would all be sitting together also.
Mm-hmm.
If they were, you know, at a table of 8 or 10. So this was a tradition that went on. And in fact, even after I retired in 1983, when we had the ASMS conference in San Antonio at the Lone Star Brewery,
mm-hmm.
Catherine Fensalow, she knew that I had retired, but she invited me to come to the conference, and I came and spent Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday at the conference, and that's the time when we had the eclipse.
Oh yes,
the eclipse of the sun, right? Practically at noon during the conference, and all these guys had their mirrors shining these eclipses up on the walls of the buildings nearby. It was a great day, really. Well, anyhow, that Wednesday evening. She asked me to direct the entire group into singing The Eyes of Texas, which I was very happy to do, and Burnaby Munson joined me, and Fred McLafferty rushed up and says, "Hey, you didn't let me know in advance, I got here 2 weeks." And Thomas Oxford was there, and so that was a great evening. One thing that kind of left me feeling funny about this was, within about 3 minutes, all the Texas A&M grads had to go off and gather into one little place and dance around in a circle and sing the Aggie War Hymn. They took it as being a school song rather than a tradition of the group. But I joined them.
Uh-huh.
I got in there and joined on with them, and I went around and went with their Aggie War Hymn. That was a great evening. Of course, I had 2 or 3 beers by then, too.
Yeah, well, that's what happens. So then, I guess ASMS came along and took over in what was figured about 69.
Yes,
and,
exactly.
So your involvement with ASMS was as the STM chairman.
For the first few years, the chairman of ASTM E14 was automatically vice president
on the
of
board,
ASMS
board.
And a member of the board of directors.
Yeah.
And within 2 or 3 years, I was president of ASTM E14 and vice chairman of ASTM E14 and vice president of ASMS. And as such, of course, was on the board of directors, and I was involved. Let's see, who was Frank? Harry Svek was president at that time, and Frank Field was a program chairman, and later on the president of ASMS. And that was a very good group of men to work with, and during the time that I was on the board of directors, we rewrote the Constitution completely.
And
this was also at the time when they didn't have a professional group do the grunt work.
No, we did it ourselves.
You guys, now you say you served Secretary STM?
That was an experience.
Because you had to keep, what did
no,
you
talk
keep,
about, yeah.
Keep track of mailing lists and all that kind of stuff as Secretary? Or well.
Yes, that was back in 1960. I have to look at my brains here.
Because there were some board meetings associated with that too, which you got the excitement of traveling to.
Mm-hmm. I'm trying to Montreal, 1964, June 1964, ASTM E14. I was treasurer of ASTM E14 in 1964, and we had our meeting in Montreal.
Mm-hmm.
And let's see, Jack Sharkey was secretary, and I was treasurer, and I think Russ Fox was president, and Norman Coggeshall was program chairman. Those were the four officers.
Mm-hmm.
And was that a hassle? Here we were, I was treasurer, we were operating in the foreign country for the first time, with mostly Americans coming to Montreal for this conference, and they don't have any Canadian money. And I don't want to have to make change, and there was a difference of about 5%, as I recall, between the Canadian dollar was worth more at that time than the American dollar. So the registration fee was something like $6 American, which would be $5.80 or something like that Canadian. Okay, most people would pay no attention to it. Here's my $6. A Canadian would come in and give me his $6 Canadian dollars. Occasionally, a guy would want his change. He wants the difference between the American and the Canadian. Or some people, Americans would come in and they would change their money to Canadian because they're staying in the hotel and eating, mm-hmm. eating at restaurants, etc. They'd have Canadian money and they want to pay in Canadian. I says, $6 American or Canadian. Sorry, can't be worried about this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And they took it very, very well. But I can recall during the early week, of course, when people are coming in and you're getting money, my gosh, Jack Sharkey and I went down to the Bank of Montreal. It was about a four-block walk down the hill from McGill University down to the bank to make this deposit. And I think we went down there and made a deposit twice a day because we didn't want this money hanging around in the hotel, in the hotel room, the hotel lobby. And so we would go down and they would sign us a little cubicle and we would count the money out and we'd take it to a cashier and open up an account. And
mm-hmm.
So everything was done on the up and up. And back in those days, too, let's see, we would have occasionally foreign speakers or occasionally some symposium. The chairman would arrange for some notable speaker to be on the program with the proviso that he have a little compensation.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so many a time, and this was all done, Jack and I, he was secretary and I was treasurer, we would write notes to ourselves and we would put $100 cash into an envelope to give to the symposium chairman to give to the as a fee to the speaker or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So we were, you know, fairly loose and easy. Mm-hmm. But we kept count of everything, but we didn't go through putting it into a bank account and writing checks.
Mm-hmm.
We handled the conference on a cash basis,
mm-hmm.
including paying off the hotel. A lot of times we would put the money in the hotel banking system, you might say, the hotel cash box, mm-hmm. Area, and have a private key to that. And then obviously you always run up a lot of hotel bills for meals for the executive committee and banquets and things of this nature. And obviously we would collect more money than we expected to have some money left over.
Yeah.
And but we would pay the hotel off cash around like, you know, $5,600 or whatever.
Yeah.
In cash for the banquet on a Wednesday night. And later on, and then what was left over we would send in to ASTM E14 headquarters. So now when we decided to go
from ASTM E14 to ASMS by now, ASTM E14 has got quite a healthy bank account built up. And at this time, I think I was chairman or vice chairman of ASTM E14, so I had charge of the monies and making reports, etc., to headquarters. And at a pretty, it wasn't a rancorous meeting, but there was some dissension on how we shall divide the money.
Mm-hmm.
Shall, how much shall, because ASTM E14 is going to be a continuing organization, and here is ASMS starting out brand new with not a penny to their name. So we ended up by giving ASMS about 3/4 of the cash on hand that ASTM E14 had built up from 1952 to 1969, 17 years. And there was about $15,000 or $20,000.
Mm-hmm.
And we gave about $15,000 of it. Now, these are not holy numbers, but we gave a major portion of it to ASTM E14. I mean to ASMS. And so ASMS started off on a cash basis, on a good basis, and I was involved in that.
So, but you also, at that point, as I was mentioning, there was a lot of paperwork that had to be taken care of. Did you dump that on, you know, people back in your office, or?
Yeah.
You know, because...
Humble, again, was very, very lax with this. ASTM would furnish the stationery.
Mm-hmm.
Every time you became the president, you got a big batch of paper and envelopes, and I just used the company secretary. And from one office to the next, from one president to the next president, passed it on. They would pass a card file of names and addresses and telephone numbers,
mm-hmm.
and a list.
Yeah.
And of course, that was always changing, adding to, subtracting from, et cetera, like that. So, Exxon just donated
that
secretarial time,
which would be quite a considerable
and postage, huh? And postage,
oh, yeah.
And things like that. To ASTM E14, and it was a good relationship. No harm done to the company. It was piddling to them, of course.
Yeah,
but it was a major help to a young, growing field.
Sure, sure. Well, let's see. There is a list of gentlemen here that you'd written to me about. Did we touch base on these people, Archie Hood?
Okay, Archie Hood. Archie Hood was the was my counterpart with Shell in Deer Park. Shell Oil Company, not Shell Development Company.
Yeah.
Shell Oil Company in Deer Park. In other words, he was in the refinery or the research laboratories, like we had research laboratories at housed with the refinery in Baytown. He was there, and Jack O'Neill was the head of the group, and Archie Hood was about my age. We golfed together. We sang together. We went to meetings together. When one of us ran out of gallium, which we used for image systems, we would call across the channel and make a trip over and borrow 10 grams of gallium. He was just a delightful person.
So he was like your counterpart, but
with Shell.
With Shell,
right?
Okay, and so you know, as a competitor, working for a competitor.
Well, he was in my lab.
Yes.
We were willing to share mass spectroscopic information, ways to do things, but not
data.
Company process information.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we can talk about how to get spectrum and how to calculate and have standardized procedures, mm-hmm. and borrow some
tubes and whatever you needed. Yeah.
Lend this, that, and the other.
Okay.
Right. So that was the relationship there.
There's Joe Franklin is here.
Well, I've mentioned him plenty of times.
Yeah.
All the other names I've mentioned.
Thomas, Frank, Field, Fred. They say Fred worked, Fred Lamp worked.
Yeah. He in fact, I've got one of those papers is published with Joe Franklin and Fred Lamp and Lumpkin, I think. He worked in the field of high intensity radiation for a while, and then also in mass spectrometry with Joe, particularly on the ion energetics.
Okay, sure.
area. And then, of course, he left and went to, where did he go? Pennsylvania.
Yeah, up east. Okay, you mentioned Gene Futrell. Did he start there out of school?
No, I don't think so. He had... Oh, Gene was with Oak Ridge Laboratories. No, he came from Dayton.
Okay, I'm not sure. Yeah. I know, you know...
Gene Futrell had been in the area of mass spectrometers, and I can recall him telling me about working when they were first doing the magnetic separation of uranium isotopes with these big old walk-in mass spectrometers that Saddam Hussein tried to build some here recently. I'm talking about massive, massive type things where you run them all day and all night separating U-235 from 237, and then you shut the whole thing down, brake vacuum, go in there and scrape it off the collector, the ion collector, to get a few milligrams. Okay, I think he was involved in that before he came to Baytown.
Okay.
But so he was there a few years, and then I think he went to Utah after that. I don't know.
Yeah, I know he's quite. My first connections with Gene were when he was at Utah in this kind of a business with the mass spec using. I can't think of the like a chemometrics business, you know, with the paralysis of a mixture and then analyzing with statistical analysis and multivariate analysis type techniques and that kind of stuff. Okay, we talked about Burnaby. Any more about
Burnaby? Burnaby is a Texan. He's from Horton, Texas, nearby my wife's hometown, actually. And he worked with Joe Franklin and with Frank Field and further development of the research work on the chemical physics. Mm-hmm. Mass spectrometer that Frank designed and had built. Burnaby came a year or two later, I think, after Futrell left.
I see.
And Burnaby stayed there for quite a number of years, and of course he's in Delaware now.
Right. Yeah. Then you mentioned Thomas Axell.
Sure.
A number of times. What about Waldron? I don't recall.
John Waldron. Do you know who he is?
Oh yes.
Okay. John Waldron was the old time chief. Mass spectroscopist, design engineer with AEI. Right. I recall, let's see, in 19... Well, are we getting too long now?
No.
This is a lot of additional information that you can't get from anybody else except me.
Well, that's why I'm here.
Okay. I mentioned very briefly a while ago that we were needing resolving power, and we're talking about resolving power in the league of the 5,000, which would help us to do things, separating 12 hydrogens from one carbon as far as mass is concerned.
Yeah.
And it wouldn't get you any nitrogen or oxygen breakdown, but differences. But you could get quite a bit with that. So we entered into a contract with CEC. I never finished that story. And in about 1960 that they had a 21-110 up and operating for us as a demonstration. Phil Kloss, who was the spectroscopist with Exxon in New Jersey at that time, he and I took my whole family up there. The children were their teenagers. They remember it with great relish. I mean, they had a great time all over Pasadena and Santa Monica and they were in their teens, and they went to all the museums, and it was a great 3 weeks. But at the end of that period, I saw that the 21-110 was not what CEC hoped for it to be. As far as I could tell, they had made a mistake in design and failed to take into account the width of the slit in trying to calculate the resolving power, the slit itself. So I recommended to Humble that the contract was based on them being able to do certain things.
Mm-hmm.
I recommended to humble that we do not purchase the CEC instrument. I guess I was more hard-hearted than the people up in New Jersey was, because the people up in New Jersey, when they hadn't bought one, mm-hmm. that they never did bear much with, this very first, earliest model. So, about that time, John Bynum, he was with ICI, and AEI, which was a new company, came out of old Metropolitan Vickers mm-hmm. company, came out with the MS-7 or the MS-8. Anyhow, it showed some resolving power. And so we entered into correspondence Metropolitan Vickers was the first few letters that I got. I kept those letters for many, many years. I don't have any more, I don't think. And then it became AEI. And finally, we entered into a contract with AEI to provide us the MS-9. This is their newest instrument. After the MS-8 that John Bynum had made us salivate for, because he was getting resolving power up around 2,000 or 3,000, and we were still stuck at 600.
Yeah.
So I went over to England for a checkout on the MS-9 in December of 1963 and met John Waldron for the first time. Now we got back to your suggestion of John Waldron. Why John Waldron? I can recall. Back up. CEC was pretty unhappy, of course.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure they were unhappy.
Because here was one of the prime mass spectrometry laboratories in the country, turned them down. But they continued to work, and they finally turned it out a good instrument. But the prototype that we were looking at just didn't do it. And, of course, MS-9 really was quite a bit way ahead of the MS-1, of the CEC-110 anyway.
Yeah, well, there's also that underlying dichotomy with the photoplate detection versus the electrical detection,
yes.
too.
MS-9 had an electrical detection, even though it was a laborious recording oscillograph, but at least you didn't have to run it through a dark room. It was a UV-sensitive paper,
mm-hmm.
Light-sensitive paper. And so I went to England, and John Waldron took me under his arm, and we spent some evenings together. He took, in fact, one weekend. We went down from Manchester to the old Roman city of Chester. It's about a 80-mile drive or something like this.
Mm-hmm.
We went down there for dinner, and he and I walked along the old Roman wall at the city of Chester. I've been back there since then, but mm-hmm. I can remember the experience of being with John Waldron. In the mind of a young spectroscopist like I was, I mean, here was this man who was a top man in this company, a noted scientist who had designed these instruments, etc. So I recall the time that John Waldron spent with me, and sure enough, later on when we got the MS-9, we received it in the fall of '63 and had it installed. He came over and visited us in our home and mm-hmm. had dinner with us and met our children. He was a fine man. And later on, years later, he dropped out of AEI, and then he came back into AEI, and the last time I saw him was in Nebraska, when we had a conference on coal chemistry in Nebraska in 19... It was in the presidential election year. Was it? I think the year that... it must have been 64. Were you there at the conference?
I didn't go to that in Nebraska. My beginnings were probably about 67 is maybe the first conference I went to in Dallas. Was there one in 67 in Dallas?
67 was in Denver.
Okay, maybe it was 66 then. Was there one in
68? 66 was in Dallas. Okay. ASTM 14
Yeah,
Dallas,
I think
66.
That was the first one I ever went to.
Right.
In my history of going to those silly things.
Gosh, I don't.
Yeah, I knew he was principal in the AI operation in Manchester.
Right.
So now you're saying you got one of the earliest MS-9s?
It was the very first one.
Okay.
The very first one that left England. And let's see, I think. FBI in England got two of them, of the first, you might say, batch of five or whatever they were. So I can recall going to school, and that's why some of the other Englishmen's names that there are, Brian Green and
Nigel Bean
was an erection engineer. Right, he came over in the fall of 63 and installed the MS-9 in Baytown, and he lived with us. Our children fell in love with this young, unmarried Englishman. Of course, he was in his 20s.
Yeah.
And our children were in their teens, but he had a beautiful singing voice, and after having him out for dinner one evening, and he was there for months and months, we finally decided, to heck with you living in a motel in Baytown, just come move into the room with my son, who was about 16 years old at the time. And so Nigel Bean just came and lived with us. Brian Green helped me learn how to twist some of the knobs on the MS-9 over in Manchester.
So he was with AEI at the time?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
He told me we still have to turn them, we still have to turn them to begin to learn how to operate the MS-9. And I spent 3 weeks at the Barton Works in Manchester in 63.
And then when the machine was shipped, Nigel was the engineer that did the installation here.
Nigel Bean was sent over in the fall of 63 and made the installation. And ran the acceptance tests and so forth like that. So he was over here a long time. Of course, it takes quite a few months to from the time you unpack one of those things and get it all set up to get it into operation. So he was quite here a number of months. He became a member of the family, really.
Yeah, that sounds like it. What about Martin Elliott then? There's Martin Elliott.
Yeah, Martin Elliott's name is on there because I just thought always very highly of a lot of these very learned Englishmen and their. You know, their ability to understand and express themselves. Martin Elliott was a favorite of mine. And Sid Evans, his name was there too. Sid Evans came along later to AEI than John Walton. I think Sid Evans actually, as far as I understand, he was the main designer on the MS-50.
Mm-hmm.
And that man just knew more vacuum technology and electronics in physics than any man that I ever spent much time with. And he was involved in the installation of the MS-50 and making quite a number of trips to Baytown when we would get in trouble, and once in a while we would call for help. And of course, at the ASMS conferences for many, many years. We would always meet and have dinner or go to a museum or something like this together.
Yeah, I haven't seen Sid for a couple of years. I'm wondering, you know, where he's ended up, what he's up to these years. So we did cover, touch base with these various gentlemen. I guess a reasonable number of them, really, the latter group are basically Englishmen that associated with the MS-9,
the MS-9
and
AI.
That's
the reason I got their names on there, I guess. Another reason is when I was looking through some of this old stuff that I had, I found a Christmas card.
Oh, really?
And their names were all on it.
Oh, that's
nice. It reminded me, hey, I haven't thought about these guys for a long time, and yet they're part of my mass spectrometry.
Mm-hmm.
You got to forget now. I've been gone for 11 years.
Yeah.
This is quite a cultural shock for me to come back into this.
Mm-hmm.
Not only for just this session today, but you know, Thomas Otzel died last year, just before the national conference, and there is a symposium planned in his honor in the mass spectrometry of petroleum chemistry.
Mm-hmm.
A symposium in honor of Thomas Otzel, Monday morning, June 1, 1992, in Washington, D.C.
Washington conference.
And Sam Sue. Yes. Within 2 weeks after Thomas had died, he had decided that they needed to do this. They probably talked about it at the ASMS conference before they left, before the end of the week was over last year in Nashville.
Mm-hmm.
But anyhow, he called me and asked within a couple of weeks if I'd be willing to give an 8 or 10 minute talk about my relationships with Thomas. Okay, about about a month ago, he called and asked if I would expand that to a 30-minute talk about some of the exact things that we're talking about now, the early days of mass spectrometry and how mass spectrometry in the field of petroleum chemistry evolved
right.
over the years. So, as I say, I'm having to go back and think about things
that
I have
about.
Not thought of. When I retired, I thought at first that it might be a good idea to do a little bit of consulting. You know, a lot of eminent scientists, when they retire, the first thing they want to do is do a little bit of consulting.
Yeah, right on.
So, right on. So, I retired in June, and I'm thinking, my gosh, in July, I was already up in Bartlesville with Shepley. And met with his group of people and his bosses, and actually they got me up there to pick my brain on the MS-50
mm-hmm.
because what they wanted to do was to buy an MS-50, and they wanted me to tell them how it could be used and what wonderful information you could get from it. And I presumably helped them out, and they did buy an MS-50. And so I went up there for a while, and then I went to another conference on petroleum and gave a talk on how mass spectrometry is a value in this field.
Mm-hmm.
And then I went to New Jersey to talk with them. And after about these three trips, I said, what did I retire for? I don't want to do this. $100, $150 a day for 2 or 3 days, all this traveling up there and back.
Mm-hmm.
I'd rather sit here in Round Rock and till my garden and prune my fruit trees and forget about mass spectrometry. And I did.
Uh-huh.
I forgot about it. I went back to the conference in 83 at Catherine Fincelaw's request. And then I went back to Nashville at your request
mm-hmm.
For this group session that we had with Frank Field and mm-hmm. Jack Sharkey last year. But other than that, it's been out of my mind.
My goodness. Well, you talk about it like it hadn't been out of your mind, so can't be too far away.
I'll tell you what, I had to do some refreshing. You see me referring to this
these
notes here?
Yes. Okay.
Those are the notes that I made based on the outline of what you want to talk about.
Yeah.
And then with this session coming up in June, and
it's good and, practice.
Right. This is good practice for that. So I call the main library in Austin and ask them if they had chem abstracts.
Uh-huh.
And the lady says, "Huh?" I said, chemical abstracts, you know, the abstracts, all the technical information of journals all over the world. She said, "Oh no, we don't replicate anything that the University of Texas might have." So last Friday, I went to the University of Texas Library, to the big Mollett Library in the chemistry, Welch Hall.
I see.
And I've got page after page here of reminding myself for this paper that I've got to write for the SMS conference.
That's looking to get back there and hit up the literature and get the research done.
It did me good to go back and realize that I could still find my way through chem abstracts.
Yeah, without a computer yet.
This is reading the paper.
Yeah, a lot of this stuff now is reduced to doing these computer searches, and you don't even, you know, get close to a book.
Oh, no, this is you know, this is talking about the stacks
right.
in the university where they got chem abstracts back to 1907, and you just go pick them out volume by volume and look through on page 14,247D.
Yeah. Fun stuff. So I think we've covered quite a bit. I was wondering if, you know, maybe we can wrap up with some grandiose ideas about where we came from and where we're going. It might be appropriate for your petroleum chemistry talk in June, or if there's any kind of stuff that you want to throw in here, you know, like something fundamental that you've run into in your career that's guided it or something like
that.
Well,
I think I've already talked about all the past of mass spectroscopy. I certainly have been happy to have been a part of it and to have gotten into the field at a time that I did, because there are very, very few people still active in the field. In fact, I'm not active. There are very few people still alive in the field who remember back those days.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really happy and in noting maybe almost 15 years ago, the fact that mass spectrometry is really beginning to make a headways in the field of medical and biologics. I think, gosh, hopefully they can find something about what causes cancer. I know that mass spectrometry is so ingrained now in all the biological laboratories, in the government laboratories involved in medicines, that this is a hope for the future. Odell and I have talked about this many times. I guess the overall field of science, my field, is that people are getting to be a bit too narrow, at least my point of view. You've heard a lot of the things that I did today, just a lot of hands-on, all types of experiences, not any one little narrow field. This is involving separations in chemistry and physics and mathematics and computers and just a whole gamut of work. And I may be wrong, but my feeling is that a lot of students are coming out with fairly narrow outlooks and fairly narrow desires on what they really want to do.
Well, I think that is the business of specialization is a reality, and I've seen that myself.
Yep. The old business annoyed more and more about less and less. It might be good in some areas, but I think we still need a lot of broad-minded thinking, just in a lot of areas.
Yes, I agree, and I think that's one of the reasons, and maybe you can give me your ideas about this. That's one of the reasons I enjoy the SMS conference, is because it covers such a broad spectrum of disciplines. I see it as a meeting where people come to, they may be mathematicians, they may be geologists, they may be MDs, they may be biologists, they may be chemists, whatever. They have one thing in common.
Right.
That's mass spectrometry.
Right. And this, I hardly ever have attended a paper in a completely different area of mass spectrometry and listened that I didn't gain something from it.
Mm-hmm.
Either a technique or an idea, a way to get something additional out of the information. So yes, I agree with you completely that even though the conference is a very broad conference,
mm-hmm.
that people ought to go not just attend their day, but to be there and learn from what the other people are doing.
Interact too. The interactions are good. One-on-one interactions, and that's harder to do as it gets bigger. But it's still a very interactive group.
Well, I'm looking forward to taking Odell, her health allowing.
Yeah, that would be great.
To in driving, seeing along some country along the way up to Washington D.C. and being there for June 1. We'll be there before then. Mm-hmm. Stay for a day or two for the conference in 1992. Hope to see you there again.
Yeah, well, I'm planning on being there, but. You know how plans are.
Yes.
They don't always work out right. Well, I don't know. I think we've probably covered pretty broad, speaking of broad areas and topics and whatnot, I think we've covered the turf pretty well, unless you have any other thoughts that you want to throw
in. Call it off,
here.
And I've enjoyed the conversation, and I probably talked longer than I should. And,
no, not at all.
I don't think I revealed anything that I shouldn't, except for being possibly too verbose.